Okay, well, thanks for coming. My name is Chris Polacek, and I teach physics at Williams Baptist University. And my colleague, John Howe, who's sitting down here, we're tag teaming the first talk of this session. We appreciate you coming to our talk. John works with Power to Change Students. This is a parachurch evangelical campus ministry that operates in Canada. It's the independent Canadian affiliate of CRU, or Campus Crusade for Christ, in the United States. And so there are some of you who have been involved with Power to Change, and many of you with InterVarsity. Those are similar kind of campus ministry organizations. I was on staff with Power to Change for many years with John. He was my boss. Now I'm teaching physics, and he is a national leader in the Power to Change ministry in Canada, in charge of directing staff training and field ministries on different campuses. And so the expertise that we bring to this talk, I'm a physicist and he's a campus minister, and we're going to be talking about biological evolution and theology. So we don't fit, but we're doing our best. And we have a project that we've been working on that has to do with evolution or evangelism through the narrative of human evolution in Canadian campus ministry. And we've been working on this for a couple of years. Now it's being funded by a grant through Fuller Seminary's Science and Theology for Emerging Adult Ministries project. And we're wrapping this project up, and we're just going to tell you what we've been doing, give you a flavor of what's afoot with it. So in a nutshell, our project is that we are creating a new gospel outline, which I'll explain in a minute, a gospel outline that helps a person, let's say a student, a science student on a university campus, discover Jesus, starting from the assumption that humans are the product of biological evolution. And our project, our gospel outline, is targeted as a tool for evangelical campus ministers, such as those who work with InterVarsity Navigators Power to Change, perhaps campus chaplains, who share the gospel regularly as part of their job with post-secondary students. But of course, it would have broader effect than perhaps just that. So the background for our project is my part, and John is going to follow me and share with you some of the outcomes of what we've been working on. Let me define a few terms, gospel and gospel outline. So these should not be controversial, but they might be. So here's how we're thinking of things from the Power to Change perspective. The gospel is, in simple terms, a specific set of truths. We might call it the good news that prefaces and answers the question, what must I do to be saved? It's the heart of evangelical theology. So everything that we're doing, working with evangelical parachurch campus ministries here to develop a tool for them, is coming from an evangelical Christian perspective and an evangelical perspective on what the gospel is. A gospel outline then presents that good news in a simple, clear, and systematic way, without what we call unnecessary rabbit trails when we train staff and Christian students on how to talk about the gospel on campus. A gospel outline has more academically been referred to in a book as a slimmed down and easy to digest version of evangelical theology. That's another way of thinking more carefully about what a gospel outline is. So what are gospel outlines? Some examples of gospel outlines. The most famous of them, arguably, would be the one that Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade for Christ, which became CRU in the U.S. and Power to Change in Canada, the Four Spiritual Laws. More formally titled, Have You Heard of the Four Spiritual Laws? That's the legal title of it. Known as the Four Laws to those who have used it through the decades, has had a tremendous influence in the evangelical world in shaping what evangelical Christians think the gospel means. What is the gospel? The Four Laws has had a tremendous influence in that. But there are many other examples of gospel outlines. The Navigators have a publication for many years called The Bridge to Life. Many of you maybe used it. Billy Graham's association, Steps to Peace with God. There are others. So gospel outlines are fairly common in evangelical practice. Now, what's a rabbit trail? A gospel outline prefaces and answers the question, what must I do to be saved, without unnecessary rabbit trails. That's actually part of the point of having a gospel outline in the practice of ministry. Rabbit trails confuse and distract from the main idea. As you may know, whenever you sit down to have an important conversation about Jesus with somebody, questions arise. Things come to mind, and the campus minister has to know how to deal with those things. But really, at the end of the day, what their greatest and deepest hope is for their recipient of their message is they'd get a glimpse of Jesus and their need for Jesus. So existing gospel outlines can be derailed by honest but tangential concerns about things such as, very often, human and cosmic origins questions. Human and cosmic origins questions arguably don't cut to the heart of the gospel. And you could share the gospel without having to talk about those things, but when the question comes up in a sincere way in a conversation, it will derail from discussing Jesus. So, for example, I like Jesus, but wait a second, 6,000 years. I'm not sure I can go further with the Jesus idea until we talk about 6,000 years. It's a rabbit trail. Rabbit trails aren't bad. They are just off topic. So our staff in campus ministries have some trained strategies. These are strategies that are typically used when origins questions, origins rabbit trails come up in discussing Jesus and the gospel and the need for a savior. The first strategy that campus ministers can use is avoidance. The avoidance strategy, simply put, is the issue of evolution comes up in an evangelistic conversation, and the campus minister will say, let's talk about that later. That's not important to what we're discussing right now. You would never put it that way, but that's in short. Or the avoidance strategy of saying different Christians believe different things about evolution, and it is not central to the gospel, and so it doesn't matter to the conversation about Jesus. That's an avoidance strategy, and it's a very good strategy when these things come up in conversation if you just want to stick to Jesus. The second strategy is to admit ignorance. It's another very good strategy. It's an honest strategy for the campus minister to simply say, I don't know. Well, let's talk about the 6,000 years problem before we move on to discuss whether I need a savior. Oh, gosh, I don't know. So can we just go back to talking about whether you need a savior? It's an honest strategy. Another strategy would be, that's fairly typical, is to simply attack evolution. When the topic comes up as a rabbit trail in the conversation, you address it by bringing out apologetics that seek to refute evolution. And in different organizations, we'll emphasize different strategies in their training of their staff. Well, what we're working on in our project is to develop a fourth strategy, a different strategy altogether, that begins with the assumption of human evolution as a starting point and leads someone toward Christ and, in fact, to Christ from that perspective. And it's different from each of these three. In order to connect evolution to the gospel, we recognize at the beginning of our project that there has been an immense volume of literature that has been written about evolution and Christian faith in general. And we have identified that much of the literature that's out there in this immense volume is largely what we would call apologetic literature. It's literature. So apologetic literature is defending something, right? It's a defense of the faith. And much of the literature that's out there that's very, very good is simply arguing for a compatibility between Christian orthodoxy and human evolution. You can hold to both, and let me give you a book that tells you how these things don't actually need to conflict with each other. But largely, these works are written at a high theological level, directed towards Christians, perhaps by theologians, for theologians, hoping some of it will trickle down to pastors, and not really targeted at all to the audience of a university student who's unchurched and doesn't understand the jargon of Christian theology. So it's very useful from our perspective to start with that. But we're not working on an apologetics project here. We don't want to add to that literature. And so then there are other works that, you know, what we have identified include within them snippets of writings on the relationship, not between human evolution and Christian theology in general and biblical theology, but human evolution and the gospel itself. So that specific set of truths in evangelical thinking that you must know and accept in order to enter the kingdom. So this is a list of some of the works that we have surveyed and relied upon. Don't ask me too many detailed questions about them because I'm a physicist and I can't remember them. But we read them. And yeah, okay. We had some ground rules for developing this tool. Surveying some literature, we wanted to come up with some ground rules for what we were putting together. First of all, theological ground rules. We're entering the worldview of the witness with our tool of the witness as an evangelical Christian. So that means non-incidental evangelical understanding of the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus. Some of these resources here in the last slide don't do that, and that's okay. But for our purposes, we have to do that because that's the audience who's going to use the tool. The tool must present a complete gospel message, answering the question, what must I do to be saved? And it must conclude with a point of personal decision to be a proper gospel outline as opposed to just a description of Christian theology. And then we have to enter the science, have some ground rules for the science of it. The worldview, the listener is an unchurched science student. So we're going to accept their worldview that there's death, suffering, and violence through all of biological history, a common ancestry for humans, evolution across millions of years by natural selection. And then this last point, a balance between the selfish gene, Dawkins and DeWall, may I say it that way, because this we understand is controversial, and we talk to biologists to understand, are we going too far this way or this way? And no two biologists agree. And so we wanted to navigate that with hands off. And our inspiration began with C.S. Lewis's book, Beyond Personality, Chapter 11, The New Men, which eventually was folded into Mere Christianity when he wrote that. C.S. Lewis's chapter discusses, is a starting point for our gospel outline. So, John, I'm going to have you come up and take over.
Thanks. So the initial idea of how our project might go, we wanted to have a collaborative approach with the other people that we work with, namely campus staff. That was our hope, that we'd be able to collaborate together and create something together. We began, I think, with the hopeful, our hopes in the process was that people would be pragmatic, even if they didn't agree with the science, that they might be pragmatic enough to accept what we were doing, that they would recognize the need that most students come on secular university campuses with an understanding of biological evolution, and then that's where they came from. So, and that this would overcome the inherent fears. So that was our assumptions going in, and that's where we started. So this is the initial reaction of our staff. I remember there's actually three more. So the majority, I would say, so this is actually 13 out of 15, they expressed skepticism and discomfort, and they assumed that there would be little opportunity for usage, even though they were involved in the process. The other group of people, I'd call these early adopters, was 2 out of 15. They expressed interest, and they immediately tried to begin to use it. And they found that there are more opportunities than they were expecting, actually, when they did try to look for it. And so I'd say there's something there, that when they actually were equipped with something, they saw more opportunities to use such a thing. And then so at that point, we realized, well, we're not really going to be able to pull ahead with this as much as we thought. So we pulled back a little bit, regrouped. We realized a few things. First, that there's a deeply ingrained polarity around evolution amongst our staff. And so I'm speaking of Power to Change student staff. That they're also less entrepreneurial than we assumed. And a hesitation of using a tool that they agreed with on a persuasions level. So we're using kind of the taxonomy there of things that they believe at a conviction level that all Christians have to hold to versus a persuasion or an opinion level. And so they would say that I don't agree with this maybe, but it's only a persuasion for me. But when push came to shove in actual usage, there was hesitation. Even though they would say, yeah, some Christians can believe this, I don't believe it, or I'm unsure about it. And then when a push came to shove of use, they wouldn't actually use it. And so we kind of pivoted to a package strategy rather than just the gospel presentation ourselves. So what we did was that we created a gospel outline, and you can ask more questions about that in the Q&A. So Chris and I went through a process of doing that along with some friends that helped us. And we packaged it into an outreach strategy with a friend of ours, Dennis Lamoureux, from the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And so he spoke on four campuses, and we put it together as an outreach strategy, asking the questions about could faith and evolution be together. So the general non-Christian feedback on the gospel presentation was a small sample size, but it was really positive, I would say. And I would say probably most of the people that talked to us about it were there was initial shock. They were shocked. And in fact, a lot of the questions moved to apologetic questions. So our initial premise on this project was to create a gospel presentation that didn't try to go around and deal with apologetics questions, but to take that conversation straight to Jesus. But oftentimes in the conversations with non-Christians, when we'd start to share it, they'd say like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. I thought Christians believed that we were created 6,000 years ago, and all these other questions. But it was a shocking thing, and often provided, I would say, a place for Jesus to fit into their worldview and conversation. With Christians, so we made this website where we hosted the gospel conversation, and we also made a Facebook site. The Facebook comments tended to trend far in one end of the polarization spectrum. There are people who are just attacking all sorts of things about us, and then there are people who are super positive about it. All of the feedback that we got from our website, evolutionandjesus.com, was very, very positive. And then there was positive but skeptical responses from our staff. And there's just, we realized that there are a lot of people are dealing with a lot of personal questions, both students and staff, about science and faith. And I think the one thing as a trainer that I realized is that in the way that we share the gospel with people and the way that we invite people into the conversations about Jesus, our staff and students often feel like they need to have an answer before they're ready to engage in the conversation. Whereas what we've created actually invites someone into a conversation that we're also trying to figure out at the same time. But people actually felt very uncomfortable with that. They felt like they needed to have all the answers, which is a more apologetic style, I would say, of looking at it. So possible next steps, training for our staff and the use of the mobile site with students. So we did make, like I said, a website, continued events. So we're hoping that we are able to continue to partner with Dennis and maybe some of you here as we continue events around Canada. We're on 64 campuses across Canada. So thinking about how we can have events there. And we're also working on creating a hard copy tool because we think that maybe having something in the staff's hands might actually help them to adopt and use this. So if you want to check out our site and you can ask questions about this, this is where we put our final draft. We call it the final first draft of our gospel presentation together, evolutioninjesus.com, and you can take a look at it. So thank you for your attention. We'll stop there and take some questions if that's all right with you, Dirk. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
So, oftentimes, in an evangelistic presentation, the first thing you check to establish with someone is that they are in fact considered. How do you approach that from the evolutionary perspective? The fact that you are a sinner, and you don't have it from sort of a traditional view of having
that. Yeah. So, I like the term that Dr. Middleton used. Imaginative. So that's kind of what we're on, is an imaginative question of what that could exactly look like. We took two tactics. I think I'll pull it here. So we had initially had two drafts. Well, actually, this is kind of it's just comical to me. So I'll share it with you. We'll see if it's funny to you. We originally had this thing called the 13 spiritual laws, which was just way too long. It's funny to some of us, I guess. So then we made two different options of that. And again, this is an imaginative process. And again, I want to remind you that it's also like a missiological and incarnational idea of what does this person already accept to be true, and how can we bring Jesus into that conversation? The two things that we talked about are kind of this premise. So the first would be that our evolved abilities that we have, so God was in the process of evangelism. I think that someone here had used the word supervising the process of evolution, and that these evolved abilities that we have, they're amazing. And we see the evidences of them all around us in the things that we're able to create, the things that we're able to do and think of. But they can become an end to themselves, where we end up turning and not worshiping God for them and saying what amazing gifts these are from God. And so reflecting Him to the world, but actually turning and worshiping ourselves and the gifts and the potentiality in that ourselves. So that's one way that we talked about it, which I found resonates with people, especially there's kind of like a WIG understanding of the future, a positive idea towards the future that we can conquer amongst young people. We can conquer these things if we just get our act together. We can solve whatever problem, you know, world hunger, whatever it is, if we just get our act together. And so the sin issue there would be kind of around the idea of we take these things that we have and we worship themselves. We worship, so it's an idolatry language. We worship ourselves, we worship the created rather than the creator. And so that was the first one. And maybe I'll let Chris talk about the second one because that was one that you liked a little more.
So that first one has, connecting to evolution, has to do with we have evolved traits. They're amazing. And you know, we've also evolved to take ourselves too seriously. The other one, of course, would come much more close to the idea of the selfish gene model, which would say, well, we are selfish creatures. There's nothing immoral about selfishness from the evolutionary perspective until you have a moral conscience that is somehow added. We're not answering the question of how that gets added. Is that a supernatural gift? Well, different people disagree on that. But naturally, then, out of that comes a sinfulness once somehow God says so. He says, now your evolved propensity to survive and reproduce in competition with others becomes a moral issue. And now I'm going to define that for you as sin, but I'm also going to give you the resource to not have to do that anymore. What, now that's where sin comes into the question. What are you going to do? Are you going to take God's resource, obey his law, whatever it is, or not?
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
I was a bit discouraged with the reaction of your staff to this. And I wonder if it comes from a Christian viewpoint in some churches, which is that argument and discussion are not required. You know, the Bible said it, I believe it, that's good, you know, that line. Whereas science is inherently an argumentative process. When I talk to non-scientists, I often tell them that scientists are paid to argue. Because if we all agree on something, it's of absolutely no interest. And I wonder if we're seeing that sort of cultural difference between the two. But it does seem to me that we've got to sort of overcome that if we're going to make any progress here. I'm not sure that's a question, but it is sort of.
Yeah, I think like I want to make sure that I say for our staff, like they're wonderful people. They're going out every day. No, I'm not saying you're not saying that either, but they're going out there day in and day out working with students and trying to get them to do something that's wildly unpopular, which is talk about their faith in the public sphere. So they're doing their best. I think that, they do come from generally, our staff do come from backgrounds that would not want to engage in this conversation. So I can't remember the person who was in here before lunch, the pastor who was talking about roots. Yeah. And so he did a great job, I think, of saying that would be very similar to where our staff would line up in terms of not wanting to have a dialogue necessarily about science.
Mm-hmm. Also, it's good to keep in mind that among campus ministry staff and every organization, hardly any of them have a science background. The science people don't go into campus ministry because, like me, they're trying to look at their shoelaces. You have to have somebody who is very personable, social, and this often brings in humanities graduates, social sciences graduates. So when a science issue comes up, there's a natural hesitancy to use anything about science, let alone this.
Maybe just to follow up if there are any other questions, but I'll follow up one thing on your point that was like, so I also do leadership development and training for our organization. If one of the things for me that was an aha moment is the need that they had or they felt that they needed to have the answer. And this was uncomfortable for them because they didn't think it was the answer. Rather than engaging in an inherently conversational approach, you know, vis-a-vis the woman at the well, John 4, where she just says, would you come and see? And so I think the paradigms of evangelism that we have probably need to be shaken in terms of just inviting people into that conversation to come and see Jesus and to ask, could this be true? And I think our staff, maybe, you know, I don't know what all the fundamental tenets there are of modernity and other things, maybe that they feel that they need to have the answer before. So that's something I'll be working on as like a trainer. Yeah.
Is it in all of creation? And if it's in all of creation, how does that speak to the goodness of a creator and his character?
Yeah, maybe I'll let Chris answer that question, but I will say one thing first. These are not the only things that we see in terms of the effects of sin. But when you're sharing the gospel with a person who is unchurched, and generally thinks that Christianity has nothing to say to them other than say, like, it's like all the other religions out there, be good. One of the things that we're trying to say is it needs to come from a place that's experientially true for them. When you share this with them, we thought about it. When you share it with them, can they say, ah, yes, this makes sense of my reality? Because gone are the days where you could say, you know, in our old models of evangelism, it could say, well, here's where it says it in the Bible. And a person would be like, oh, shoot. Yeah, I didn't recognize that. And they would have a personal experience with the Bible because they believed it as an authority. So working on a secular campus today, what we were trying to say, so we do have Bible verses all over if you go to the website. But the point is to say that both of these things, people can understand the inherent tensions in these things. when you talk to them, that like we do have this propensity to look to the future as hopeful, and there can be an issue there. And that was talked about the other day too, the dystopian versus the utopian idea of the future. The selfishness one, I think that people do recognize that inherent tension where everything around them is telling them to be both selfish and altruistic at the same time. And they could just, they feel that tension and they wonder how they can resolve that tension and who can resolve that tension for them. And that's where we tried to point them to Jesus. So that's just to say that's where we're coming from. And I'll let Chris maybe speak to your question a little bit more.
Just quickly, it's a fantastic question, but it really goes beyond the scope of our project, which was a gospel presentation for humans who were going to be confident saying, you're selfish, and there's something wrong with that. I would just say from my limited amateur understanding of all that's involved, the word selfish comes from the selfish gene, and a better term, I think, would be self-centered, but that's where the selfish comes from, and biologists talk about it. So the self-centeredness, as far as I understand, in the rest of nature, not including humans, is not immoral. Because they're not moral creatures. Self-centeredness is natural. Sinfulness is when you put a moral agency in place, and that's what humans have, and that's who we're speaking to, those who have a moral agency.
We have 3 minutes for another question.
Just a very quick one. I was just wondering, so you mentioned your website. Are there supplementary resources that you have with that, or just, you know, a more fully developed package, maybe?
No, we just have the website and we're trying to make a physical tool, but obviously we leaned on, you know, we stood on the shoulders of giants for a lot of these things. So those books are all great. There's really one thing we realized, and one of the reasons we wanted to do this, and we're very thankful to Fuller and Steam for allowing us the space to do this, is that there really is nobody in this space, as far as we know, that's trying to do evangelism with it. There's a lot of great, wonderful people doing Christian education resources around that. And so there, if you check out the STEAM website, STEAM project, it's called through Fuller. They have, I think there's like 30 groups or something like that. And we're the only one doing something kind of like evangelistic. So the other 29 are all focusing on Christian education resources. So if you're looking for that, that's a great, great reference for you. Great place to go evangelistically. Like, honestly, there's us and C.S. Lewis from 50 years ago. So
one chapter only.
Yeah. Which if you read it, it's actually quite stunning. I hadn't, to my shame, never read it, and Chris sent it to me and I just couldn't believe this guy wrote this 50 years ago.
No evangelical reads to the end of Mere Christianity. That's a lesson I learned.
Yeah. Any last questions? Okay. Thank you.